Hi, Ted here. Anyway, this is the third show in our little three-show sequence in honor of the summer solstice and all of the psychological implications that such a thing might have for us. I hope you enjoy. Welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name's Ted McIntyre. Well, in the 1890s, in the American West, while the genocide of the Native American population was proceeding apace, there formed up a new religious practice called the ghost dance. The ghost dance was based on various kinds of existing indigenous practices, the circle dance, I think it's called. The ghost dance was widely practiced throughout much of the West. And according to Wikipedia, it says that the proper practice of the dance would reunite the living with spirits of the dead, bring the spirits to fight on their behalf, end the American westward expansion by the white man, and bring peace, prosperity, and unity to the Native American peoples throughout the region. In fact, the ghost dance further inspired something called the ghost shirts, which is a white shirt that was supposed to prevent bullets from penetrating. If the person wearing the shirt was of the right, you know, spiritual frame, the bullets of the U.S. Army would not hurt them. And of course, those shirts were worn by people at Wounded Knee, and there you go. Well, I guess I mention this point because it's an example, a specific example of a religious practice reacting to an ongoing, inevitable, and overwhelming kind of tragedy, right? The Native Americans faced genocide, right? Let's speak honestly. And this was one of many, of course, not the only, but one of many responses. And I quote it because I think it's apropos to our discussion of climate change. I mean, climate change has the same attributes of this inexorable, unstoppable, destructive thing that is coming our way, much like the demographic expansion of the white population into the American West, right? It's got many of the same hallmarks. And I would suggest that religion writ large, right? Religion that talks about how do you align yourself with the universe? How do you make yourself happy? How do you do the right thing? Religion, in that sense, will accommodate the impact of climate change, right? It's going to happen. There will be a reaction to it. Either the reaction will be proactive, or the accommodation will be proactive in the sense that religions find ways to help people come to terms and live their best lives in the face of coming climate change, or it will be reactive, and you will likely have lots of sects of cults, you know, chanting about how climate change is God's punishment on us all, and et cetera, et cetera. Right? So religion is going to be impacted by climate change. Recently, we have been talking here about how, you know, playing a mind game, imagining sort of an intellectual game of what would a religion that accommodates climate change and helps humanity find its way forward in the face of climate change, what would that religion look like, right? And so I've been holding forth for a while, talking about these things, probably exposing my own biases unwittingly. And of course, I don't have academic qualifications or even necessarily a lot of references for the things we're talking about. But I hope that you will accept the conversation in the interest of a conversation starter, maybe something new to think about. If you do have an opinion, please let me know. So our project is to build a religious worldview that helps humanity accommodate to climate change, right? Come to terms with it. And just as a reminder, we put up a show that said, well, the sun is a pretty reasonable candidate for a deity in such a religion. Why? It's because the sun is real. It's in the sky every day. The sun gives us a creation story. And in fact, science would tell us that we wouldn't exist if the sun didn't exist. So in many concrete ways, the sun created humanity. The sun drives all of the processes on Earth. We'll come back to that in a minute. But I mean, the food that you eat, the water that you drink is all given to you through a process of solar irradiation of the planet that provides energy to drive the systems on the planet, right? So the sun is a great giver of life to us. The sun, the solar, we can learn lessons from a solar deity, right? We'll talk about those, lessons that of how the world works. Through science, we can learn, you know, what has the sun done to put us in a position where we are now in terms of having a vibrant, livable planet? Okay. And finally, the sun inspires awe. Right? So I guess for those reasons, it's a podcast we put up. And I mean, the sun could be considered a deity. But then you say, well, okay, what's the human connection to that deity? People often want an emotional human connection to the divine. And I would suggest, and we have put up a second podcast where we said, yeah, there are plenty of sort of religious people. No, that's the wrong word. There are plenty of people who play the role that we typically think of as religious, right? So, I mean, Al Gore and Bill McKibben are prophets. They are calling forth, telling us what's going to go wrong if we don't change our ways, right? Predicting the future, much as the biblical prophets did, right? There are saints that have, you know, devoted their lives to the study of climate change. There are the bodhisattvas we talked about and nominated Greta Thunberg to be an eco bodhisattva. Right? But there are people that would help. There are people that live today that have devoted themselves to these questions that could serve as sort of valuable emotional intermediaries for people who wanted to practice a religion of a sun deity. And that's all great. That's all great. But I think the another major question is, how would a solar religion create a moral philosophy? Right? That's the other thing that religions do for us. They say, you know, they tell you how to live. They tell you, don't kill your neighbor, right? Treat others as yourself. All that kind of stuff, right? Can I steal? Is it okay to steal? Right? There's lots of precepts. And, well, you know, things that you can and cannot do based on your moral philosophy, which is derived from religion, which is derived from God knows what, right? And so it's in that sense we want to talk today. How would a solar religion derive a moral philosophy? So in order to answer that kind of question, we would again look at history, right? So there's this dude from a long time ago named Thomas Aquinas, better known as St. Thomas Aquinas. You may have heard of him. He wrote a book back in the day. Basically, what he did was to take the sort of unincorporated, basically unorganized teachings of Christianity, and he knew about Plato and Aristotle. He had Greek philosophers, and basically, he used kind of those philosophical principles to order a lot of the beliefs of the church, give it some sort of structure. And of course, a lot of people involved in that endeavor, so I'm not going to. But Thomas Aquinas is a pretty good place to look, where he used guidance to organize theological thought. We can do similar, although probably not as good as Thomas Aquinas. Anyway, Aquinas' book was called Summa Theologica, Summary of Theology. It's, and a shout out to that, we're going to call this episode Solus Theologia, the Theology of the Son. Anyway, we, instead of using Plato and Aristotle, we're going to use science as kind of a guide, right? That's the muse that sits above all this and helps us order the things we learn. And the question is, what is the teaching that the Son deity, Saul, what does that give us? What have we learned? Well, science has revealed to us what the Son has been up to, basically creating the earth as a essentially closed ecosystem, right? And you've seen that, right? Everyone's seen the picture of Earth rise over the moon, right? Everything we care about is on that planet. You've all seen pictures of the pale blue dot from Carl Sagan, right? Everything we care about is on that planet. It's all inside the atmosphere, right? What's input, the only input into the Earth is sunlight from the sun, maybe some cosmic rays, right, to give us some genetic evolution, but primarily the energy that's coming in is from the sun. What goes out is some kind of light, mostly infrared light, right? That goes down a whole path of climate science. But sunlight is in, is the source of the thing that comes into our planet. Everything else is inside kind of a hermetic bottle. This is what science teaches us. And what the sun has created is a system where everything is cyclic. Everything has a reuse, right? And it's almost a commonplace, right? But everything in a natural ecosystem gets reused somehow, right? The dung beetle eats the lion's droppings, right? And then the bird eats the dung beetle, and then the lion eats the bird, and it goes around and around and around. I mean, there's nothing left over. There's nothing that is not being used. I mean, that's a pretty good lesson for we humans, who tend to think that when we're done with something, we can throw it away and it stops existing. No, it doesn't. I mean, many people think of Gaia, Earth, as the sort of a thing living in and of itself, right? You've heard of the Gaia philosophy. Right? Anyway, that's one kind of teaching that the sun gives us, that we're in a closed ecosystem where everything has a circularity. It's also taught us by science that everything in that ecosystem is equally essential, right? That in the ecosystem, it's not created for the service of any one of the constituents. And not to put too fine a point on it, that means the Earth's ecosystem writ large is not created to support human happiness, right? Humans are simply part of a much bigger ecosystem, and that we have a role to play, but we cannot dominate, we're just part of something bigger than ourselves. And that's a tough lesson for humans to learn. Quite honestly, through the ages, again, without going too far down the sort of Copernican route, where humans found out that they weren't the center of the universe, right? So the implications of the teachings of the sun are that humans have to live their lives in a way that aligns with the cyclicality and the sustainability that the rest of the planet displays, and that humans are not in any way special. I think that second teaching is quite useful in the moral philosophy perspective, because if humans are not special within the ecosystem, then sort of the implication of that is that humans don't have any sort of the idea of equality of all people, and in fact of all the other elements of the ecosystem, is kind of built in. And you get to what amounts to a golden rule, right? Do unto others as they would have, as they would do unto you, right? That the ecosystem, that your moral teachings, your actions have to be consistent with how do you maintain, what do you have to do in order to maintain the ecological system of the planet, right? Which is, again, a science phrase, but I mean, how do you keep the planet going according to the laws that the sun has given us, right? Aside from the golden rule, you also have this concept of nonviolence, right? If everyone is in the system, this ecosystem, Gaia, so to speak, is on an equal footing from the flies, the dung beetles, right up to the humans, then, you know, nonviolence against those elements is sort of a precept you can accept. And so you get to nonviolence through these teachings as well. And I would say that, you know, at least in the beginning, you can conceive of this violence against the ecosystem as all of the terrible stuff that we are doing in human exploitation of the planet, right? A lot of that stuff is just not consistent with a sustainable planet long term, right? But I mean, these rules of the do unto others as you would to yourself and nonviolence that fall out of our concepts of what the ecological system has taught us. For example, for me, it comes to a point of, you know, how does a human live in that ecosystem? I mean, you have to eat, right? You have to eat. And by definition, you're going to do violence to something, whether it be a soybean plant or a pig that you're going to butcher to eat or whatever, right? I mean, there's humans are almost by definition violent. You've heard of nature being described as red in tooth and claw, right? The competition of nature for the evolution, all that kind of stuff. Fair enough. But from a moral and moral alignment perspective, it seems to me appropriate to think of teachings of sort of indigenous people, right? So again, there's a huge bountiful source of teachings about how to behave in an ecological system from even just Native Americans, but around the world, there are all these teachings. But I guess you've all heard of the sort of examples where the people who would slaughter a bison or a deer, it was not an industrial process. They respected this animal and they were grateful and they thanked the animal for giving them food. And they essentially persisted in a relationship of reciprocity with the natural world that was giving them food. I think that's at least a start under a moral code of sun theology, right? How do you you can't eat, but you have to be in some symbiotic relationship with that. And that point being, that's a far cry from the combined animal feeding operations that you have, right, where there's thousands of pigs in cages that are just being fed up for the slaughter. I mean, it's a whole different way of approaching things. So there's in a few minute podcast, we're not going to create a moral philosophy. Sorry to disappoint. But you can begin to think about how would you order your life and derive moral principles that you kind of want to get to, right, of the golden rule, care for your fellow human beings, right? How would you get to those in a way that is consistent with the challenge of climate change? Because climate change will demand a rethinking of all these things as the situation gets worse and worse and more unhappy going forward. We can either react and worry about retribution from some invisible deity. We can align ourselves with common sense teachings of science, what the sun god has taught us, if you want to put it that way, in order to perhaps more successfully deal with the challenges we face. So there you go. I will stop there. The sun is an appropriate deity. You can make a case that the sun should be a deity. You can recognize and comprehend different structures of prophets and saints that help us think through and how to relate to this religion. And the sun's teaching gives us a moral philosophy, grounds for moral philosophy. Will this stuff be incorporated into the teachings of established religions? I can only hope. I mean, there's ways to do it. But one way or the other, I hope you will find it entertaining to think about these things, just to nod and say, interesting conversation. Hope you've enjoyed it. Thanks a lot. So we'll put up links to some of the stuff we talked about at the MCAN blog. It's massclimateaction.org/blog. If you have an idea about solar religion or some comment on this, please send us an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. podcast@massclimateaction.net. Let us know if we're on the right track. I hope you're listening to the show on your smartphone using one of the modern podcast distribution apps. You can find us anywhere. Please ask your friends to listen to us on their modern podcast distribution app. We want to thank our good friend D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support. We want to close where we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon to safeguard our future. So thanks for listening. I'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.